This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title the Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
I called up Umair Irfan to talk about this phrase, peak carbon. Umair reports on climate change over at Vox. He says peak carbon is a goal, a buzzword, a date, sometime in the future, when carbon emissions finally hit their apex and then start to decline globally. Greenhouse gas emissions have only been going one direction since the middle of the 21st century, up. Think of peak carbon as a measure of self-control, a sign that governments around the world are bending the curve when it comes to climate change. How far off is peak carbon globally, do you think?
It depends on who you ask. You know, one research team that I spoke to, this group called Climate Analytics, they said that we may have already achieved peak carbon, that 2023 may have been the high watermark for human output of heat-trapping gases.
When you say we may have already reached peak carbon, I get this like little spark of hope.
I mean, I've heard the situation described as sort of tapping the brakes as we're heading towards the cliff. I mean, we're still getting closer and closer. We're still putting out more greenhouse gas emissions. Even if they're declining, we're still adding to the net total of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, even if that rate isn't as fast as it used to be. So it's not really cause for celebration just yet.
If you, like me, hear Umair here and think, hold it, I thought I was getting some good news here. Yeah, he gets it. Keep in mind, the United States hit peak carbon in 2005. And yet,
the United States is still the second largest greenhouse gas emitter in the world, behind China and ahead of India. So the U.S. still has a long way to go as far as reducing its emissions.
Over the last few weeks, President Biden has announced a flurry of rules meant to chip away at these emissions. There have been rules that cut back on tailpipe pollution, rules that order power companies to cut coal emissions, rules designed to speed up permitting for clean energy.
We're progressively doing more than ever, but still not enough. And that's just kind of the point where we're at.
Today on the show, why it is the best of times and the worst of times when it comes to climate policy. Peak carbon or no? I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hi, I'm Katie Riley. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, Donald Trump became the first former U.S. president in history to face a criminal trial.
The defendant repeatedly made false statements on New York business records.
This is not a trial. This is not an act of criminality.
We cannot and will not normalize serious criminal conduct.
This is the story of his first week in court, told through the transcripts. Listen now to the Slow Newscast wherever you get your podcasts.
To see the trouble with peak carbon, like what it means and what it doesn't, I feel like we don't have to look very far. Like, we just have to look at the United States and our own climate policy. As we talked about, the U.S. hit peak carbon domestically in 2005. But it's funny because if you look at a chart since then, it's not like carbon emissions have simply gone down. They've gone down and then they've gone up and then they've gone down and then they've gone up. It looks like a series of bumps that are, it's like we're falling down the stairs kind of thing. Can you tell me about that? Like, why aren't emissions simply sinking?
Well, emissions are associated with a lot of other economic factors, as you're getting into. You know, it's not just environmental policy and it's not just fuel switching. You know, as we see populations grow, sometimes we see emissions increase, but also depending on, you know, shifts in our economy and, you know, things like the COVID-19 pandemic, when we saw this global shutdown in travel and a lot of people staying home, we saw a big drop in emissions globally. And then we saw a rebound back to an even higher level as, you know, homes, businesses, and travel all opened back up. So the challenge here is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions steadily while also delivering economic growth and sustenance for much of the world. The United States has largely managed to do that, but it hasn't been a smooth road, as you have noted.
Yeah, I mean, when you put it like that, it just makes me think like so much of this reduction in greenhouse gases has to do with luck a little bit. Like there's policy, but there's also just things that happen in the economy that cause things to go up or down?
Yeah, that's right. You know, there are always going to be things like inflation, which is making it a lot harder to deploy all sorts of energy to do any kind of big construction project because financing costs have gone up. And so that's kind of slowing the pace of deployment of clean energy. At the same time, though, you know, a lot of the gains we've seen in terms of technology, those are going to be durable. The improvements in energy efficiency, the drop in costs of solar energy and of wind mean that renewables are often the cheapest source of new energy, sometimes even cheaper than running existing fossil fuel power plants in many parts of the country and in many parts of the world. And a lot of analysts and a lot of projections look at this and they say that, you know, a lot of this decline is still likely to continue, that we're still likely to see an ongoing drop in greenhouse gas emissions in the coming years. The question is, at what pace?
Another thing that has messed with this pace since 2005 has been U.S. politics. President Obama had to achieve a lot of his climate goals unilaterally. He targeted things like vehicle emissions and power plants through the Environmental Protection Agency. But the problem with this approach was made clear when Trump won in 2016. Now he was in charge of proposing emissions rules at the EPA.
Trump basically had a lot of antipathy towards all kinds of federal regulation, but that really did manifest in terms of environmental regulations, particularly under Scott Pruitt at the Environmental Protection Agency. There were more than 100 environmental regulations that the Trump administration started the process of rolling back. The thing is, though, when it comes to federal regulations, you can't simply dictate which ones you're going to enforce and which ones you're not. There's a whole process. And as you go through that process, you know, a lot of states and other stakeholders, they can sue you to try to block that. And so while they did start the ball rolling as far as undoing a lot of environmental regulations like emission standards for cars or putting together new rules for power plants that were much weaker than what the Obama administration proposed, they were blocked by the courts. And essentially, a lot of those rules ended up getting stalled or just not implemented. And so when Trump left office and when Biden took over, he had pretty much a blank slate on a lot of environmental regulations, but was still, you know, years behind as far as the calendar that was needed in order to implement some of the biggest changes.
Okay. So then Biden comes in. What did he promise to do when he was running for president?
I think Biden was pretty clear-eyed that, you know, he was going to have limited support from Congress. And so before taking office, you know, while he was campaigning, he laid out a list of executive actions that he wanted to take on the climate. But then after taking office and actually getting a majority in the Senate, I think the Biden administration became a little bit more ambitious and started laying out a legislative agenda that could also start to actually procure new money to address climate change. And they've actually been somewhat successful in terms of getting their agenda through Congress. The big trio that I would highlight are the CHIPS Act, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, and the Inflation Reduction Act.
Notably, these aren't necessarily climate bills, at least not by name, but they just have an incredible impact on the climate.
Right. These are all laws, as you note, that don't explicitly have climate change in the name, but kind of affect the effort in the United States to address climate change by injecting more money into the solutions. And so they're obviously, you know, if you've been following these, the passage of these bills, they're much smaller in scope than what was originally proposed. I recall the Inflation Reduction Act was initially something around $2 trillion, and it came out to something less than half of that. But it's still the largest single injection of money that just about any country has devoted towards dealing with climate change. And so this includes things like tax credits for clean energy. This includes things like more money for building electric vehicle chargers, for incentives to upgrade efficiency in buildings. And it's been kind of remarkable that a lot of this actually happened with bipartisan support.
Well, everyone likes money.
Well, yes, everyone likes money, but like Republicans have also shown that they've been willing to act out of spite when it comes to money and say no to things like funding for high-speed rail or Medicaid expansion in their states. And so it's not just money, but there was some sort of ideological coherence that they were able to find here.
Well, you're talking about injecting a whole lot of money into the economy for solutions. It sounds like carrots to me. Incentives. Are there any sticks? Are there any enforcement mechanisms here about you should do this or something else will happen?
I mean, that's a good observation. I mean, obviously, yes, in order to get bipartisan support, people are much more likely to sign on for incentives and not on new regulation. And so that's why the Biden administration has been trying to use existing regulations, existing laws to try to ratchet down greenhouse gas emissions. And so things like the fuel economy standards for cars and trucks, you know, limiting the emissions that come out of tailpipes, those are based on laws that were passed decades ago, but have a mechanism that allows them to be revised as new technology comes onto the market.
We're talking about EPA rules here?
Yes, these are the EPA regulations that were recently passed in the past couple of weeks regarding cars and power plants.
That sounds fragile to me.
Well, I mean, I think as we've observed with the ping-ponging back and forth between Obama, Trump, and then Biden here, you know, I think there's also something of a frustration in the federal courts about how this is going back and forth. And so there is some sort of push towards trying to get something a little bit more deeply seated. Eventually, the states and the industry and the federal government will have to come to some sort of agreement at some point.
After the break, more on what these new rules do and whether a Trump win in November might do them in. This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier, and it could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, or even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
I'm Jerusalem Demsis. I'm a writer at The Atlantic. And my beat, in many ways, is to challenge the conventional wisdom. I've written about how the problem with local democracy might just be too much voting, about how some environmental laws actually squash green energy development, and about how maybe the big demographic question of the day isn't overpopulation, but underpopulation. My new show is called Good on Paper. It questions what we really know about popular narratives with a new guest every Tuesday. Find and follow Good on Paper from The Atlantic, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm wondering if we can dig in on the new EPA rules here. Over the last couple of weeks, it seems to me that President Biden has been ramping up his attention to climate. Like, he's announced $7 billion in federal solar power grants. He's launched a new website to apply for Climate Corps jobs. And then he also announced new EPA rules. So tell me a little bit about those rules. What are they? What do they do?
Right. So the EPA is, with these series of rules, targeting the largest sources of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. And so last month, they finalized rules on tailpipes from cars and trucks, which is, transportation is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions. And so ratcheting down on the amount of pollution that they're allowed to produce from their tailpipes over the course of the coming decades. And essentially what this does is it moves the goalposts so aggressively that in a lot of cases, the main way manufacturers will have to comply with these rules is with electrification.
So the rules are so strict, they force a change.
Right. And a key point there is that a lot of car makers in the U.S. have said that they're betting big on electrification. You know, General Motors has said that they envision an all-electric future. This sort of, you know, ties a bow on that. And then similarly, at the state level, you have states like California that are saying that they intend to ban sales of all new combustion vehicles by 2035. So these automakers are being pressured from both states and from the federal government and from their own internal commitments that they need to clean up their act and shift towards more electrification. So that's one ball that's already underway, that's already getting rolling. The other big rule that just came out last week was the series of four distinct rules targeting pollution from coal and gas-fired power plants. And so with regards to coal and gas, they have to now limit or control about 90% of their greenhouse gas emissions by 2039.
What does that mean to control the emissions? Like not emit them in the first place?
That means either not emit them in the first place, it means stop using these plants as much, or it means using technologies like carbon capture and storage. So basically filtering out the carbon before it reaches the atmosphere.
I want to talk about how durable these kinds of rules are, because my understanding is that, especially the rule on emissions from power plants, that's basically like a new version of an Obama rule that made it all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court basically said, yeah, you can't do it like this. So why does the Biden administration think things will go differently for them this time?
Well, they say this is not their first go around. You know, Biden was there under Obama as the vice president seeing all this happen. And so I'm sure he took some lessons from that. And similarly, his EPA administrator, Michael Regan, you know, has worked at the EPA before as a career staffer and so has some familiarity with the rulemaking process. And they're quite cognizant that the courts are not necessarily in their favor. And so they're being very careful in terms of drafting these rules. And at the same time, you know, the industry does crave certainty here. You know, when you're building a power plant, this is a structure that has to stand for 20, 30, 50 years. And these are multi-million, multi-billion dollar investments. And so for power companies, they really do want to have some kind of foundation upon which that they can start making investments. And oftentimes they may just pick the most stringent goalposts that they're expecting rather than hoping for better rules, because they do have to start, you know, putting power on the grid right now. Even if the regulation does get weakened in the future, the industry may end up moving ahead of it.
You sound optimistic about these rules, that this push and pull somehow is communicated to the companies like, okay, like you just need to abide by something, please, because we're going to keep going back and forth here. And so you should try to meet the goal here that's the strictest. Is that fair?
I think so. I mean, if you talk to even the fossil fuel producers, I think they do seem to agree that clean energy is going to be the dominant source of new energy on the power grid. And that is where their main profits and their main, you know, revenue sources are going to be in the coming years. And they see sort of the writing on the wall that, like, you know, even if the United States doesn't have the strictest rules, other countries might have strict rules too. Many of these are multinational companies that are building turbines in the United States, but also in other countries, companies like General Electric, and then also the major fossil fuel producers like Exxon and Chevron. And whatever they can do to get ahead of that is probably something that's going to pay dividends for them in the future. And so the question then is just the pace. How quickly can they implement these changes? And that remains to be seen how much appetite there is politically to push for them, as well as how much technology and investment will be there to facilitate that turn.
Given that there is this climate accord that sets a goal of net zero emissions by 2050, what happens if, or maybe when, we miss that goal?
If we miss those targets, what happens? Well, it just means that the world will be warmer, that the situation will be more harmful than it would have been otherwise.
But there's no accountability here?
part of the reason these agreements were so hard fought and so difficult was precisely because that accountability was kind of stripped out of them. That in earlier versions of climate accords, there were mandates, there were enforcement mechanisms in place, but gradually, in order to get more countries to buy in, basically to get every country in the world to buy in, we essentially had to make every country stick to voluntary commitments that they would agree to ramp up over time. At the same time, you know, a lot of countries are also really concerned about energy security, you know, with the Russian accelerated invasion of Ukraine and the cutoff of natural gas from Russia to Europe, a lot of countries are desperately trying to find other sources of energy. And the U.S. is trying to help them because the U.S. is now the largest producer of oil and gas in the world right now. And it's producing more than it ever has in its history and is planning to export a lot more natural gas to bolster its allies in Europe and in other parts of the world. So there is also this diplomatic tension of trying to maintain energy security on top of trying to meet these international environmental goals.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're basically implying that the U.S. is not leading here. And I know that you've cited this stat that, for instance, China installed more solar panels last year than the U.S. did in its entire history. Are other countries kind of beating us to the punch and then forcing changes domestically as well?
Well, China's an interesting example. I mean, I don't think that their deployment of solar panels was really out of any concerted interest for the environment per se. This is just a country that's really hungry for energy, and it just turns out that renewable energy is the cheapest and fastest way to get more energy onto the grid. China has also deployed a fair amount of coal in recent years and also nuclear power as well. But because of their immense scale, the whole world benefits when, you know, China is achieving these economies of scale and able to sell its very cheap solar panels to the rest of the world. Similarly, China is now one of the largest exporters of electric vehicles. BYD is one of the largest EV companies in the world now. I saw one for the first time in Brazil. You don't see them in the United States because the U.S. imposes tariffs on Chinese goods. And so they're not competitive in the U.S. market just yet. But that also raises another policy question that, like, if we are really concerned about climate change, does it really matter where these things are being built? If our goal is to make that transition as fast as possible, shouldn't we defer manufacturing to the places where that can do it as big as possible, as cheap as possible?
Yeah, it's interesting because, as you said, like, the whole thing here now is not whether carbon emissions are falling, but how fast they're falling. And so speed is the game.
Right. And in addition, you know, we're talking about a global picture here, that even though the United States has reduced its emissions for decades, you know, other countries have been increasing their emissions. And so they need to peak their emissions as well. Now, China is projected to reach peak greenhouse gas emissions in the coming decade, but India may not reach peak emissions until 2045.
Yeah, it feels like good news, but also maybe not good enough.
That is kind of the recurring theme with all things climate, that, you know, we're in a state where we're doing more than we've ever have, but it's still not enough. And we're further away from our goals than we've ever been. And that's just kind of the point we're always going to be living in from the years to come. I mean, it seems like some of the most important, most ambitious targets under our big climate agreements, under the Paris Climate Agreement, are basically out of reach at this point based on the current pace. And yet, you know, we're also moving faster than we ever have as far as curbing greenhouse gas emissions. Things have never looked better as far as the technology goes. So both of these things have to be true at the same time. The picture is bright and grim.
Umair, I'm really grateful for your time. Thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Mary.
Umair Irfan is a correspondent at Vox. And that's our show. If you're a fan of what you're listening to here at What Next, the best way to support our work is to join Slate Plus. Go on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. What Next is produced by Paige Osborne, Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Anna Phillips, and Madeline Ducharme. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you back here next time.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS, we are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.